But I want to hone in right from the beginning, if I can, to the record at 14, which is the board's opinion. The Dr. Bash stated that he conducted meta-analysis on the information of record. He did not provide any copies of his work product used in arriving at his conclusions. Ill-conducted meta-analysis may be biased owing to exclusion of relevant studies or inclusion of inadequate studies. I don't see in there where they've rejected it because his analysis was inadequate, but rather rejected because he had not supported his underlying information, for example, the x-rays, which we at this court have said don't have to be submitted necessarily. At that point, if the board felt that this was important to this doctor's opinion, which is clearly favorable to the veteran who served his country, why is there not a duty to assist to get that before they reject it for the very reason that these reports were not submitted?
Yes, Your Honor. If I understand your question, that's going to a Locklear analysis. What we have here is that at the actual board decision, that's where the board determined the probative value of the AFIP report and of Dr. Bash's opinion in comparison to the AFIP report. To suggest that the board should have basically reviewed Dr. Bash's opinion and found that he had a weak supporting rationale goes directly
to... Where does it say a weak supporting rationale? I mean, I don't see that in this board opinion. We've talked about it, but I don't see that the board relied on that. They didn't say his rationale is weak. They said he didn't submit his studies, and those studies could be biased.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry. Yes. The board was basing it on the fact that he had not submitted the meta-analysis, which goes to the rationale for his opinion.
Well, when they're doing this analysis, they have to also review whether or not the duty to assist had been completed, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So they have to look at certain documents, do they not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And here they're saying that certain documents were not submitted. And because they weren't submitted, not because the rationale is bad, because they weren't submitted, we're going to give less weight to this doctor's opinion.
Well, Your Honor, this would be an expansion of the duty to assist.
Would it be an expansion? Where have we ever said that the duty to assist does not require the board? Where does the statute not say that it does not require the board or the secretary to not get documentation that could be helpful to the case to substantiate it if it's reasonably available?
Yes, Your Honor. This goes more to the private records or records that are not in this in a federal department. How this will be an expansion of the duty to assist is that we'd be required to look at an opinion like Dr. Bash's and do a pre-decisional adjudication as to
why
what
does it have to be pre-decisional? Why don't you just sit there, you're reading it, you read this doctor's opinion, and you say, geez, this is very interesting. This could support his case. But you know what? I'd like to see the underlying data. And then he goes out, he or she, the board, whatever, goes out and asks for the underlying data. This isn't a question of, gee, this is confusing, and I have other statements here. This is a question of actually going out and getting additional information to support an opinion that is not stated to be inadequate in and of itself, but because this board member had some belief that it might be biased underneath. It may not be biased underneath. It may be very supportive. It may result in an award of benefits for a veteran who served his country. Why? What duty to assist does not include that?
Well, Your Honor, maybe something that would shed some light on this is actually the VA adjudication manual and how it looks, how it accepts private records and records that are not from the agency. And if I could just cite to that, it's actually at M21. 1MR Part 3, Subpart 4, Chapter 5, Section 11A, where it says that
Counsel,
VA...
could you slow down a little bit?
Oh, I'm so sorry, Your Honor.
And if you don't mind repeating the site that you just provided.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. M21-1MR Part 3, Subpart 4, Chapter 5, Section 11A.
I think I got it.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Subpart 4, Chapter 5, did you say?
Chapter 5, Section 11A.
Okay.
And where it says VA will accept evidence from non-VA sources at face value. Basically, when VA is accepting evidence, it's going to look at the evidence at face value. It looked at the AFIP
report. But it didn't do that here. The face value is this doctor, who is fully qualified from everything we can see, has an opinion based on his underlying analysis and presented it. And this board member did not do what you just mentioned in 1MR, accepted on face value. He said, hey, I don't have the underlying data, which might be biased.
Well, accepting it on face value is that something akin, if I could have an analogy, to a scoreboard. When VA gets the actual medical evidence, it doesn't go straight into an analysis of the evidence. It accepts it as, this is an opinion from Dr. Bash. We will accept it at face value that it's correct, it's adequate, it has supporting analysis. This is an opinion from the AFIP. We'll accept it as is, it's correct, it has an analysis. And therefore, before it gets to that, the actual analysis that the board does in providing reasons or basis for its decision as it did here, it just accepts that evidence as is. And what the Secretary is suggesting is that by getting to Dr. Bash's, that probative value of his opinion, the board would have had to actually look at the opinion, analyze the opinion, and report that there was missing evidence, which is an expansion of the duty to assist.
So is it the Secretary's view that once we get to the point that we've accepted this evidence and we start analyzing it, at that point, it doesn't matter if we believe some additional information might help the veteran, we don't need to get it?
Well, Your Honor, not necessarily that, but I think this situation, the distinction in this situation is that we have the AFIP report, which is adequate, and there hasn't been an argument that was inadequate possibly until today, but we have an adequate AFIP report that's necessary for appellate review of this decision. In order to go beyond that, what VA's duty to assist is to obtain records, to obtain evidence to substantiate a claim. There's a difference between getting the evidence necessary to substantiate a claim versus deciding that claim. So it's not necessarily that the board, that VA will not get whatever necessary records, treatment, whether it be treatment records or evidence that it becomes aware of, but what the Secretary's position is that it would not know until the analysis of the actual opinion and it started to weigh the evidence, Dr. Bash's opinion and the AFIP report and Dr. Montemurano's opinion, that it would find out that the meta-analysis that was not attached to this opinion did not enable it to support it as a more probative opinion than the AFIP.
What about the benefit of the doubt? Doctor submits this information. He's qualified. Submits his opinion and his results of the information. And the board doesn't sit there and say, accept that the information is favorable to the veteran. It says, gee, it may be biased against the veteran. Where's the benefit of the doubt there?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, if you could please repeat.
In other words, the doctor submits his opinion. He says, I reviewed this analysis, et cetera. I've done the mega testing, so forth, et cetera. He submits it in. This is his conclusion based on that. And the board, in reviewing that, says, oh, well, gee, Doc, your underlying data may be biased. I'm gonna assume it's biased, in effect, and give it less weight. How does the benefit of the doubt apply to that? I mean, it seems to me that two strikes are going against a veteran here. One, I don't want to go get this additional information because it's already been submitted, and now I'm analyzing it. And two, gee, it could be biased, therefore I'm going to give less weight to it. Does that really comport with the Secretary's duty?
Well, Your Honor, it's the equipoise of the evidence, and it wasn't just that Dr. Bash's opinion was not supported by the meta-analysis that he stated he conducted. It was also that the AFIP report was consistent with the IOM, the NAS,
the
VA findings, exactly, Your Honor. And it had reviewed 7,702 Agent Orange cases, had the 12 that were brain tumors, and had the tissue samples, had the claims file, and that was also the alternative basis that the board provided. So it wasn't just that the board looked at Dr. Bash's opinion and did not give it the benefit of the doubt. It looked at all of the evidence, and came up with
it. They clearly laid it out as two of them.
Yes,
either,
sir,
requires resort to speculation because we don't have these reports, which may be biased, and then the or requires the greatest. It's clearly not. It's not the cumulative. It's one or the other, as laid out by the board.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, let me. Continue the line that Brother Castle is questioning, and direct your attention again to page 14 of the record. And the quote at the top of that page, the board finds, however, that private medical opinions of Drs. Dixon, Bash, and Montemurano warrant a lesser degree of probative weight than the IFP opinion. And then Judge Castle already quoted the following sentence there. I'd like to actually have you look down to a part that wasn't quoted. The board has no information on how his analysis was performed or to the extent in which he included or excluded data. The board finds that these opinions either require resort to speculation, albeit based upon some degree of medical knowledge, I'm assuming they're referring to the doctors, in that there is admittedly no demonstrated direct and immediate causal relationship between herbicide exposure and the development of his brain tumor, or require that a greater degree of evidentiary weight be applied to the statistical conclusions of Dr. Bash over published findings of the IOM, NAS, and VA. Is it your view, counsel, that in this paragraph, fully read, that there's more here from the board than simply he didn't provide supporting documentation?
Yes, Your Honor. That is our view. That as has been stated, it was more than just the supporting documentation. It was also the NAS public notice that was given. It was the IOM studies. It was VA's own findings, and that the fact that the AFIP report was consistent with the scientific and medical literature as well as VA's own findings.
Is there any indication that the doctor's reports at issue were inadequate?
No, Your Honor. The issue was more of what was the underlying basis. Dr. Bash's opinion was kind of the segue into Dr. Montemurano's opinion. So the fact that there was not this supporting meta-analysis and in conjunction with the AFIP report being consistent with the scientific and medical literature, that was more of the issue than rather it was an adequate opinion. As I stated, VA accepts the evidence at face value. So from all purposes, it was there to substantiate the claim, and VA accepted it as such.
If there had been a determination that the opinions were inadequate, would there be any discussion of its probative value? Or let me rephrase that. What would have happened had the opinions been viewed as inadequate? I asked appellant's counsel the same question.
Well, Your Honor, in terms of, there would be, of course, at this level of discussion by the board concerning the adequacy. But again, this goes more to the probative value of the opinion rather than the inadequacy of the opinion. The board found that Dr. Bash's, Dr. Montemurano's opinions were actually competent in order to substantiate the claim, so it was not necessarily an inadequacy issue.
Okay. Thank you.
I have some questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
First of all, you indicate, as I understood your argument, that you said that one of your arguments was that there was no requirement under the duty to assist to obtain these studies because of our decision in Locklear.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, Locklear dealt with an entirely different stage of the adjudication. It dealt with 5103 little a notice, and it said at that stage of the adjudication, there was no need to actually provide a sort of a pre-look at the decision in order to inform the veteran or the claimant what information that they can bring to the table, right?
Yes, sir.
So I don't see how Locklear supports your position other than statements made in Locklear in an entirely different position. Indeed, it seems to me while you're involved in the adjudication and you're evaluating the evidence, that's when you might well determine that you need another piece of evidence to assist the veteran, to develop evidence relative that is relevant to the claim and relevant to the adjudication of the claim. Do you have any comment on that? I mean, do you believe we should extend Locklear, or are you willing to accept that it applies to an entirely different part of the adjudication process and really doesn't have any application here.
Well, Your Honor, we note that Locklear did deal with a 5103 subsection A notice issue, but the ruling in Locklear is something that can be applied to this case, and that it discussed predecisional adjudication. This is a distinct case in terms of the facts, because this was the board opinion that was procured under the board's ability to obtain an independent medical opinion under 20.901. But in response, the board actually gave 20.903 notice to the veteran, to the claimant, stating that she could provide further evidence and argument if necessary. So that's where there's a distinction, in that this was the board developing the evidence. But what the Secretary states is that we did notify. Our duty to assist was also to notify, the claimant of what she needed to submit. And that's what we did. In order to develop, to say that we needed to, after receiving the evidence, we told her that she could submit, go through it, analyze it, and then say, well, this might be lacking, we might find this less probative, is where the expansion of the duty to assist comes in, and why we would think that Locklear could be expanded to apply to this.
But our case law says the duty to exist all the way through the final board decision. We've said that a number of times. So it clearly, in my view, exists during the adjudication process. I mean, the duty to assist is different than the duty to notify. I think we've said you look at the VA adjudication system as a continuum with different obligations at different times for different reasons. So I have a hard time with that. Now, the second issue that I wanted to ask you about is, as I understood it when you talked about the M21, you were taking the position that we should be analyzing the absence of these studies in Dr. Bash's opinion as if they were private records. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. What I stated by referencing the VA adjudication manual was how VA receives and will accept evidence at face value when it receives it. So that was the...
But you're talking... they're talking.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, about private records. Yes, Your Honor.
And the statute has a provision that talks specifically about the Secretary's duty with regard to private records, and that's in 5103A, subsection B. And there are certain obligations that are placed upon the Secretary if you're going to classify this as a private record. Now tell me, if you take a minute, if you want and read that subsection B there, and even subsection C, but subsection B I think is the one that is most applicable, and tell me, you know, if this is a private record, how is the VA satisfied its duty to assist under the statute?
If I could just please take a moment to
sure,
read that section,
means.
Your Honor,
mm-hmm.
please. All right, Your Honor, in addressing your question as to 5103A subsection B, the Secretary believes that it did provide provide the duty to assist, and that it notified, and not to get the duty to notify and duty to assist confused.
This is a separate duty to notify here.
Right. Yeah. Correct, Your Honor. But it notified of the notified appellant first of the evidence. And, of course, it attempted to obtain whatever evidence it could. Part of obtaining the evidence that it could to substantiate the claim was the AFIP report.
Okay, I understand that.
So that was the first section.
Now we're talking about these reports of Dr. Bash, right? What subsection B says is if the appellant or the claimant reasonably identifies or adequately identifies private records, then the Secretary's got to make an effort to find them. Am I right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So far? And if the Secretary tries to get them, first of all, they got to try to get them. And if they try to get them and can't get them, then they need to tell the claimant, hey, we tried, we couldn't get them, wanted to let you know, and by the way, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to proceed now that we don't have, we've tried to get these records and couldn't get them. So if you're going to, if the secretary is taking a position, these are private records under subsection B, I don't see, haven't heard you say, tell me how this the duties under subsection B have been satisfied. Now, maybe I misunderstood your argument. Maybe they're not private records, but tell me again, because when you cited that section in the M21, it certainly dealt with, seemed to me to deal with private records.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand your question. And the distinction here is that there is a private record, Dr. Bash's opinion, that we state that is a private record. What 5103A subsection B, if we were to interpret it that we had to get additional records, what we're stating is that we got Dr. Bash's opinion. In this case, the appellant actually submitted it herself or had Dr. Bash submit it. However, this would be requiring us to go beyond and do almost a follow-up, read the actual opinion and analyze it and say that this meta-analysis is missing. Now, whether this meta-analysis is a private record is something that we're not comfortable with saying that it is, because it's actually part and parcel of an opinion that is already that was already submitted and is already before the board. Now, presuming that, as I stated in the manual, we accept this evidence at face value, then to go, we assume that it's complete, then to go back and have to do a follow-up and essentially review it and find that this would be less probative matched up against the AFIP report.
What if the veteran said, this was a hearing, and the veteran said during the hearing before the board said, let's take, I don't want to take this too far out of this factual situation, but let's say the individual had an injury to his knee, and the VA examined him, and he said, and during the hearing he says, you know what, I had x-rays of this knee right after I injured it, and he went on. Would the VA have an obligation to go and try to get those x-rays?
Well, Your Honor, that goes to a hair issue where we might need to actually, we might be put on notice, and under hair, when we are on notice of such private medical records, we could ask for them even without.
Would you have to? Would you have an obligation to?
If I could just take a moment. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, that's fine. I'm interested in the answer. This is not
a race.
I mean, I'm not trying to put you under pressure here. I'm just trying to find out, understand, the scope of your argument.
Well, Your Honor, as I was stating, according to Hare, the claimant does not have to make a specific request but can just refer pertinent private medical examinations or private treatment records, and that was that case citing to Ivy. But I guess the problem here is that this is still the actual private record was Dr. Bash's opinion. The meta-analysis is underlying this opinion, and whether going back and having to follow up, that's where we stated we would probably get into a Locklear situation where we keep on asking and asking or trying to
obtain.
You're not
going to persuade me. You can argue Locklear, but you're not going to persuade me that it applies here.
Yes, Your Honor. You may
have success in other places, but not with me. So.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand.
Do you understand the 95% confidence level issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you explain it to me?
Yes, Your Honor. Basically, 5107B states that the Secretary shall consider all information and lay a medical evidence of record in a case before the Secretary with respect to benefits under laws administered by the Secretary. When there's an approximate balance of positive and negative evidence regarding any issue material to the determination of a matter, the Secretary shall give the benefit of the doubt to the claimant. Now, following up with that is the Gilbert case, which stated the limits of the benefit of the doubt, which says that the benefit of the doubt doctrine does not apply during the process of submitting or gathering evidence. The statute provides that it becomes an issue only after consideration of all evidence and material of record. And even furthermore, this court's recent decision in Darius, where it stated that the benefit of the doubt doctrine is a legal construct to be applied by an adjudicatory body when the evidence is approximately balanced, not by a medical professional when rendering an opinion as to the cause of a veteran's death. So basically, as the statute itself states in plain language, this is what the secretary, as the adjudicatory body, applies when looking at evidence and looking at the material of record. It's not something that the VA will enforce on medical professionals or on this case.
But what is the 95% confidence level? I mean, what does that mean to AFIP, to whomever?
Well, in this case, because, again, one of the nuances of this case was that they utilized the IOM, and this was kind of part and parcel of the Agent Orange Act 1991 and the Veterans Agent, the Agent Orange update of 2002 that went to the rulemaking. The 95% confidence level was just a way to ensure in determining whether a certain disease, in this case brain cancer, was absolutely connected to or not connected to exposure to Agent Orange.
Is there anything in the record that explains it? Because the board decision doesn't explain it. Is there anything in the record that explains what this 95% level is?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. The board had just stated that medical professionals did not have to apply the 50% level, and that it acknowledged that it did use, the IOM does use a 95% level.
So if I'm a doctor, and I say, I have to be 95% sure before I think there's a connection here, and VA asks me and says, is it more likely than not? And I answer you and say, it's unlikely. But the underlying basis for that is because I'm not 95% sure. Doesn't that impact the benefit of the doubt doctrine?
Well, still, Your Honor, it impacts the doctrine just as that this is evidence that the board is going to look at.
Is asking a doctor, is it more likely than not? And the doctor's answering, well, most people would think that's a 50-51%. But the doctor's answering because he has these studies, and he's saying, well, it doesn't reach the 95% level, therefore it's not more likely than not. Isn't there something, shouldn't the board have discussed that? Shouldn't that be explained? You don't understand it, and I don't understand it.
Your Honor, that might have been an issue that the board could have discussed, but in terms of applying the benefit of the doubt, the secretary did it correctly, and in that medical professionals do not have to apply that benefit. And
have a professional doctor coming in and telling the board. I mean, on its face value, doctor comes in and says, more likely than not, okay, we accept that, we move on. Now I have another expert coming in saying, but wait a minute. You got to understand what they mean when they say more likely than not. They're saying that it didn't reach a 95% level. At least I think that's what the arguments are here. I don't understand the 95%, I'm telling you. But what this expert is saying, but when that expert says it's unlikely, he's saying it didn't reach the 95% level. Wouldn't that undercut? I mean, shouldn't the board understand what is meant by a response to the question, is it more likely than not?
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe something that might be instructive in terms of how the board will look at this evidence in a 95% confidence level, or as I heard Your Honor state earlier, if there was a 5% confidence level to opposing counsel, under Saxon Mullen, there's actually the board will look at whether this evidence rises to some type of connection or if there's no connection. So that's all that 95% confidence.
We don't have any explanation by the board, do we?
No, Your Honor.
And doesn't that go to the fact that the board rejected Dr. Bash on one basis because, his underlying data might be biased and therefore we have to speculate? And then on the second basis, and what the felon has asked for us to do is reverse, but in this particular situation, the board gave greater weight to the IOM, NAS, and VA, and yet we have no explanation of this 95% confidence level that is used and how it interacts with a more likely than not benefit of the doubt concept, et cetera.
Yes, Your Honor. If I could please take a moment, Your Honor,
absolutely,
to confer with co-counsel.
And in fact, we're going to add 10 minutes to your time.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry about that. Your Honor, to address your question in terms of whether the board did not get into a discussion necessarily, but it did discuss the difference between presumptive service connection under 1116B, and this case is a direct service connection issue. Now, of course, the IOM study in this case that it utilized was a study that was not conducted particularly for this veteran or group of veterans suffering from this type of brain glioma. The idea is that it was coming under the rulemaking function of the secretary in terms of determining what was presumptive or not, but it still used this medical literature in determining, in weighing the evidence on whether veteran could be directly service connected.
But isn't that exactly the point? You have a standard set for presumptive, which is when the evidence reaches 50%, indicating there's a connection according to statute. And now we have some kind of discussions of a 95% confidence level. And you have a board, in effect, rejecting a doctor's opinion who are on tests that weren't submitted, so the board thought they might be speculative. And you have them rejecting that in part because we have published IOM, NAS, and VA opinions that have not added this particular disease to the presumptive list. Well, just because it's not added to the presumptive list doesn't necessarily mean you can't have direct. But I think Judge Hagel pointed out earlier, what are the specific facts in this case that would indicate a direct causation? And intertwined in this whole thing seems to be whether or not one individual doctor or two doctors might be coming in, overcoming the presumption, or perhaps the presumption is based on a different confidence level of 95%, and how does that impact the analysis? None of this is discussed by the board, is it?
To my recollection, no, Your Honor.
In fact, it could fall in the speculation arena.
Possibly, Your Honor, but the key in this case is, as stated, the board did go into its discussion regarding and separated that there was presumptive service connection, but that it would attempt to see if appellant could receive direct service connection.
But then it rejected some doctor's opinions because of the studies saying it wasn't presumptive.
Correct, Your Honor. And it was also looking at the Agent Orange registry. The Secretary's position is that even though these studies were done on a 95% confidence level and were done not for this individual case of this veteran or a group of veterans who had his type of brain glioma, it's still the fact that it is medical literature that is separate from, while it's part and parcel of the rulemaking function, it's still congruent with the VA legal standard. And as medical literature, it can come in with a higher confidence level and state that this is our findings based on our scientific studies. And then to backtrack to what it being consistent with the VA studies, the NAS, the IOM, and then the AFRP's own studies, the 7,702 cases that are reviewed from the Agent Orange registry and came up with its own analysis. And I noticed that the AFIP report did apply a 50% standard, at least likely or not, in weighing all of and looking at all this evidence, and looking at the NAS, the IOM, its
but
own
does
agent.
The, does the AFIP report, doesn't it rely on these other studies?
Yes, it does cite to the IOM.
And the board, my point is the board didn't explain how these interact. The board didn't point to a statute and say, look, these studies are based on a 50%, and that's what we're going to rely on, the 50%. The board didn't address the 95% confidence level and explain why it is or is not important in this particular case, did it?
No, Your Honor, but the fact still remains that it did provide reasons or basis for its decision in terms of the direct service connection, even though it did not necessarily extrapolate what it might should have with 116B rulemaking versus whether it's just scientific medical literature that the AFIP report was looking at and coming to its opinion.
Counsel, on the some of the studies referred to, where does brain cancer show up in the four categories of the NAS findings in occupational and environmental exposure to herbicides? Do you understand my question?
I'm sorry, I don't, Your Honor.
Are you familiar with the Gleason case?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, under the under some of the what were these called, the subsequent publications, the amendments or whatever they were referred to as 2002, 2004, 2006, my question is, where does brain cancer show up, either under sufficient evidence of association, limited or suggested evidence of association, which is category 2, inadequate or insufficient evidence of, to determine association, category 3, or category 4, limited or suggested evidence of no association?
Your Honor, I'm not sure, but I could submit a supplemental memorandum addressing that particular
issue. Let me ask you a question. That question, if you look at page 596 of the record.
Can I please see
596.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, the second paragraph. Is that, and I had this question, so I'm happy that Judge Davis asked it. Is this the answer to Judge Davis's question?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
You don't know, you believe so, or it is, or it isn't?
Your Honor, without having the, based on this, I would say yes, but without having the actual study in front of me, I can't say that I'm comfortable saying fully.
Okay. It is.
Are there any further questions?
I have a question I'm reluctant to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. There is a board decision in this case that was removed from the record, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the appellant has specifically withdrawn the argument about the bias of the board member in this case. But what's the Secretary's position on what if any consideration we should give to that prior decision, number one, and does the Secretary have a position that if this case is remanded, whether or not it should be returned to the same board member?
Oh, well, Your Honor, to address your first question as to whether what weight should be given to the November 2005 board decision, because it was vacated in the December 2005 decision, and we have the October 2006 decision, the Secretary would look at would request that the court look at this actual October 2006 decision, since the November 2005 was vacated for due process reasons, mainly that there might have been evidence that the claimant didn't get a chance to comment on that was actually used in that decision.
But that evidence was evidence that tended to bear on the board member's view of Dr. Bash's credibility, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. In answering your second question on what the court should do,
what the secretary.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The chairman should do.
What the board should do in this case, in order to just, even though that there was no finding necessarily that Veterans Law Judge Pelletier should be disqualified from this case under 1912. The Secretary thinks it might be prudent just to make sure it's under the regulation of 1912 to avoid any circumstances that
any appearance,
thank you, Your Honor, that would look like bias, perhaps return it to another board member just to be in line with that so that there's no other issues that might arise.
If this case is remanded, would the General Counsel make that recommendation to the Chairman?
Your Honor, if I could just have a moment, please. Thank you, Your Honor. While we cannot necessarily say they'd be bound by it, we would be more than comfortable to make that recommendation.
Let me ask a follow-up to that. Counsel, the general administrative law standards for disqualification based on bias is it's necessary to prove actual bias. Mere allegations of bias is not enough. 1912 seems to be a little bit different than the general administrative law standard. So is 1912 interpreted to require actual bias as well, or merely the appearance of, I think the language here is, which might give the impression of bias, either for or against the appellant?
Before you answer.
Sure, that's enough.
Please add 1 minute.
Your Honor, we would look at the language, which is the circumstances which might give the impression of bias. Whether there needs to be a direct showing of bias, again, this case is different because this is not necessarily bias against or for the claimant under 19.12 or something that would look like that, but rather against what could be construed as against Dr. Bash himself. So it would be the circumstances which might give the impression for or against the appellant. Are there any further questions?
No. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The Secretary respectfully requests that the Court affirm the Board's October 2nd, 2006 decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Overby.
Thank you, Your Honors. A few matters. I know Judge Hagel was having a difficulty understanding the concept of why we believe direct service connection could be established. I think by way of analogy and for illustration purposes, I think the best way to look at this is for radiation-exposed veterans, since we're dealing with exposure here. The Secretary does have, under 3.309, radiation exposure disabilities or diseases that are presumed to be related to military service or their exposure to radiation. So the veteran doesn't have to overcome that burden of medical nexus. However, there are other diseases or disabilities under 3.311 that actually deal with, they're not on the presumptive list, but the Secretary recognizes that if a medical expert actually makes the opinion, then they could actually establish service connection. We believe the same could be said for the facts in this case. With respect to why a review of the claims file would be critical in this particular case, one, Dr. Bash did glean information from the claims file that, yes, he was exposed to Agent Orange or was in Vietnam, and it's presumed that he was exposed to herbicides. But more importantly, that he didn't have a family history of cancer. He documented other detailed information as to why we believe the claims file review is definitely pertinent. The problem with the AFIP opinion, IP opinion relies on the fact of the presumptive studies that were done. And Judge Davis, you asked the question of my opposing counsel with respect to the four categories. Unfortunately, I could not introduce it because it wasn't before the Board of Veterans Appeals. The 2006 update has been released, and unfortunately it's at home, but I have read it, and they have changed the actual category. It's not pertinent to this particular case because we're not seeking actual presumptive service connection. We once again believe, though, that the opinion obtained by the board from AFIP is based on the presumptive standards done by the National Academy of Science as well as Institute of Medicine. But once again, we would have to reiterate that the request and the opinion from AFIP in the cover letter, there's actually two places in the record on appeal. One is from my record I printed out is record 602, but there's the cover letter that it's twice as well as the opinion. The cover letter states, and it's addressed to Ms. Pelletier, this case was reviewed and we agree with your assessment. The following page, record 603, it's the letter and the opinion itself to Ms. Pelletier. In your letter of April 25, 2005, paragraph, then the next paragraph, it says, as noted in your letter, according to Table 1.1 of the Veterans and Agent Orange Update 2002 Institute of Medicine, And it goes on talking about the no association. The problem with this opinion is if you actually look at the opinion request itself from the Board of Veterans' Appeals at record 578 through 580, there is no indication there, or at least some sort of assessment provided, and I would hope that there would not be in an opinion request. But apparently the AFIP is relying on something that they were provided saying we agree with your assessment. Two, they're relying on Table 1.1 of the Agent Orange Update of 2002, where I can not ascertain from the opinion request or the record of 972 pages where they actually provided that table to the AFIP. So going to our argument with respect to reversal, we believe this diminishes the value of the AFIP opinion and how it was obtained. It just clearly from the record, it looks like some questions were raised to the AFIP, but it's not in the actual opinion request letter.
Well, if you on page 580 of the record, isn't there a list of enclosures?
Your Honor, it does say attachments, VA claims file, tissue samples. And what the attachments are, I cannot answer. I don't know if there was a separate letter because, according to the AFIP, they say, as noted in your letter, if you look at the actual April 25, 2005 letter, there's nothing in which they reference Table 1.1. So we're trying to figure out exactly what they're talking about whenever they're making their medical opinion. But once again, the opinion itself is based on the fact of presumptive service connection and the studies done, that 95% level that we're still trying to get clarification of. But we believe this diminishes the value of the opinion relied on by the board to deny service connection for the cause of the veteran's death. As for the duty to assist issues,
before you go there, counsel, let me just on the 2006 update, you understand that the category changed from 4 to 3, right?
Yes.
And 3 is limited or suggestive evidence of no association.
Sorry, the 2006 update, again, I did not submit it.
I have it here, but I'm just reading you what it says, that's all. But it changed from a no association, well, Category 4, which was a suggestive evidence of association or inadequate or insufficient evidence to determine association. Category 3 says limited or suggestive evidence of no association. But you're right, it did change in 2006.
Okay. The medical experts, I believe, are starting to recognize that these things are changing. Regardless, again, that would go to the adding the gliomas or brain tumors to the presumptive list. We're not asking the court to even go into the presumptive service connection. We believe the medical evidence, as well as the other evidence, establishes the link between the herbicide exposure and the veteran's cause of death, which was the brain tumor. And with respect to the duty to assist, we believe that, as I indicated in my opening, the Federal Circuit in the decision in Wood basically said that the duty to assist goes on unless there is no reasonable possibility that exists for the secretary to obtain any particular records. With respect to this case, they've identified Dr. Bash at least identified what he relied on. Therefore, at a bare minimum, once the board was put on notice of that under the court's decision in Stone, and if I may just quote very briefly what the court said in Stone, that mere cursory dismissal of the possibility of the existence of evidence beneficial to the appellant's claim did not satisfy the secretary's duty to assist. The secretary had a duty to inform the appellant that she needed to submit the studies she relied on in support of her claim to attempt to obtain the studies from Dr. Mather, Dr. Mather's consideration in making her determination, or at a minimum provide specific citations to the materials.
What's the pinpoint on that?
The pinpoint cites, Your Honor, 14 Vet App 121.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
You asked us, the court, to reverse.
Yes, Your Honor.
Given 1116B3, which says that an association between the occurrence of a disease in humans and exposure to herbicide agents shall be considered to be positive for the purposes of this section if the credible evidence for the association is equal to or outweighs the credible evidence against the association, in as much as that's the statutory basis for it. How could we reverse the finding of the board with this information in the file that it is not listed, does not reach to that level, and the only information against it is Dr. Bash, who did certain minor studies also? I mean, how could you? It comes down to, again, the questioning that Judge Hagel gave you before. It's really a presumption that the doctor is coming up with. It's a statistical analysis that he weighed it on and is now saying that there's a connection. How can the court reverse? How is it not reasonable for the secretary to rely on that information?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that it is a presumption. If you look at any sort of medical opinion, it's a presumption of a certain what the cause is. There's nothing definitive. In the same light, as I mentioned earlier about...
No, but my point is, let's accept Dr. Bash. Let's accept in his view it's 50 more likely than not because of his studies that he did. Let's accept that. In light of the statutory requirement of 1116B3, the NAS and all these other groups have decided that it has not reached that level. Why is it unreasonable for the board not to rely on that?
I think it's not unreasonable for the board to rely on that if Ms. Polovic was seeking service connection under a presumptive basis. This specifically deals with presumption. I don't believe this applies in this particular case because of the fact that as I explained to Judge Hagel, dealing with radiogenic diseases, obviously the Secretary has recognized that if it's not presumptive, you can still establish service connection, as well as the Federal Circuit's decision in common.
Can you establish that by your own testing of statistics, I guess is the question.
Do you have any others?
Judge Hagel?
Davis. Yeah, I wanted to. Could I inquire a little
Would
bit?
Would you like to add a little bit? How long? A minute? 2 minutes?
Pardon me?
Would you like to add five?
No, I'm sorry. We're just passing.
You sure? Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case will be submitted. We will come down and greet counsel.
All rise. This honorable court is adjourned until further notice.